is stop now. Is stop now, and then let you have four people sitting up here, and let them each make whatever kind of comments they make. That's up to them. They'll go in the order in which they are. I'm not going to give long introductions. Luis Giusti, who's sitting right here to my left, has his office here, former head of PDVSA, about as knowledgeable a fellow as there is around on what's happening in the oil and gas field in this hemisphere and elsewhere. And he was of great help, enormous help, in putting this book together. And I do thank him immensely for that. Frank Verastro runs the energy program here at CSIS. He wrote the U.S. chapter. He also has a long history and background in the energy field. And he'll go right after that. Annette Hester, who is Brazilian-born, lives in Calgary. She worked very hard on this book. I don't think it could have been done if she hadn't kept prodding me. Do this, raise money, go there, get this done. And she wrote, essentially, the Canadian chapter. And she'll say a word about Canada. Laura Fleischer, who's sitting next to her, wrote two chapters. He's a senior associate here at CSIS. And he wrote one chapter on Venezuela, which is of some interest to all of you, I expect. And he wrote the chapter on Ecuador, which is of some interest these days, too. I suggested to him that he focus on Venezuela for the moment. You can't do everything. And then finally, Peter DeShazo, who came from the State Department here, it's about 2 years ago, I guess, 2.5 years, to run the Americas program at CSIS. And he wrote what I think is a fascinating chapter on Bolivia. Okay, that's the program. And I'll just let them get up whenever they're ready.
I just wanted to say thank you to Sydney. This was both a privilege and a pleasure for me to work on this book. And for Veronica as well. Veronica used to spend a lot of time in our office and talk about things that needed to be done or changed as these chapters moved forward and what the new deadlines were. So it was a pivotal piece of work. I would like to say that it was because of Sydney's book and the timing of it that I understand prompted President Bush to actually go to Brazil after several years of kind of ignoring the hemisphere. So your timing is impeccable, as well as your writing style and your insights. Let me just focus on three substantive comments. And the first is the contribution of the Western Hemisphere to U.S. energy supply. It's frequently misunderstood. Most Americans think that the United States is 50% dependent on the Middle East. Well, in fact, the Western Hemisphere provides about 60% of our oil imports and about 99% of our gas imports. The Middle East, by contrast, provides about 20% of our petroleum imports, and it's about 10 or 11% of demand. Having said that, though, the prospects as we go forward, since U.S. production is declining, when you look at Canada, conventional production is declining. Non-conventional production is going up, but I don't think we'll meet the NEB targets of 4 million barrels a day by 2012, for example. Mexico, unless they make considerable investment with Cantarell declining, is in serious or, if not, dire circumstances. And when you look at what's been going on with Venezuela between the two countries, it really argues for increased cooperation and dialogue between the two countries. And the third point is really when you look at the global energy map and the changes that are going on. When you look at demand that's forecast between now and 2030, it's like a 60% increase in energy demand. And you look at especially the oil demand. Clearly, the map is changing. We've got geographic concentration as well as concentration in non-OECD countries. So now they're not only now the biggest consumers when you add China and India, but they also will be the biggest resource holders for oil and gas and increasingly for coal after you take out the United States. When that happens, the map is changing. I would argue the game is changing. The rules, depending on the Western Hemisphere versus the non-OECD country, the rules are changing. New players with India and China, and that requires that maybe new policy approaches need to be changed as well. And if energy security is such a big component of the U.S. policymaking in the future, I would argue that we need to be spending more time looking at the Western Hemisphere and jointly developing cooperative projects that make sense. So, Sydney, this is a great testament, great starting point, and let's go on. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to try to use my 4 minutes wisely and tell you first what a pleasure it's been to do this project with Sydney, with Veronica, with all our co-authors. And it was, I see many people in the room whom I've originally, Murray included, and Kenna, and what I originally went and said, you know, there's this project that it's really wonderful, and you got to get behind it because it's really worth doing. And to see the book now and to see all the conferences that we did, and more than anything, to actually see that the timing is kind of impeccable. And so it's been incredible. It's been wonderful. So I thank everybody for working together on this. Canada, which I had the pleasure of writing the chapter with Sydney, comes out in a very interesting way because we didn't think it was going to be sort of a very big chapter, but it turns out that is somewhat of an anchor of stability in the sea of crazy Latin America. But on the other hand, Canada's changes, what energy and what is happening and the changes that Canada is facing because of this new geopolitics that Frank was talking about is really quite interesting. And we covered that in the book. But further to that, I think we are moving to even more interesting, and we can't. We knew that as we were writing, the book was out of date as fast as we could edit because things just move so fast. But we have a new government in Alberta who is putting in some very, very different changes that I think we expected, but it's still in early days. Changes even in the regulatory and splitting up, going back to the Alberta Energy and Utilities Board, having two separate functions. A lot of very significant changes, which would be very interesting to watch. And further to that, I really see my work further from this has been in going back to the hemisphere and saying, okay, who are the countries who have the same strategic interests? And maybe cooperation between them is going to be a lot easier to come than the ones that don't have the same strategic interests. And sort of further analysis to that. And looking forward to doing a lot more work in the issue. And a pleasure to see you all here. Thank you for coming.
I feel like this is passing the baton somehow. Let me just say a couple of words about Ecuador and then a couple of more words about Venezuela. I guess if it's a little bit early to tell what the government of Rafael Correa in Ecuador is going to say or do in their new constitution about the oil sector. I think when we look at Ecuador, one thing is very clear, and that is the petroleum industry there has been as unstable in the past 10 years as has the country been. And it doesn't seem to me that that's likely to change very much in the foreseeable future. Output in the oil fields of Ecuador since the country seized the fields of Occidental last year has been dropping. And now Correa has made the decision, or at least made the announcement, that Ecuador is going to rely on Venezuela and Mr. Chavez for advice and perhaps investment. And he's been recently talking about a strategic alliance, whatever that means. Well, I think that's enough for a couple minutes on Ecuador. About Venezuela, I could say any of a million things, and they would probably change tomorrow. I don't know. The first thing I think to emphasize is that the approaching May 1st deadline for an ambitious Chavez plan to wrest control of several major oil projects from U.S. and European companies is what's going to happen when that deadline approaches, I think, is still very much up in the air. ExxonMobil chairman Rex Tillerson recently suggested that his company might be forced to abandon a major heavy crude project because of growing troubles with Chavez. Just one day later, Venezuelan tax authorities raided the Exxon offices in Caracas. Routine tax investigations, they said. If you believe that, there are several bridges that, you know, we might be able to sell you this evening. It's obvious that the Venezuelans heard his comments and took action immediately the next day. I think in the end, what is certain is that PDVSA is going to get its 60% stake in these projects, and the question of compensation is still very much up in the air. For the first time, I've heard Venezuelan officials say today that there might not be any compensation. So we'll see about that one. If we take PDVSA officials at their word, there is no immediate crisis in PDVSA. If there is no immediate crisis, there's certainly one at the doorstep. The company just last month said that their investment in, quote, social development almost doubled in 2006 to almost $14 billion, while spending on exploration badly trailed its global peers. It recently had to float a $7.5 billion bond issue. Now, whether that's going to be used for PDVSA purposes or President Chavez purposes, I suppose we'll find out eventually. Meanwhile, the seemingly inexorable march towards socialism continues in Venezuela. Chavez's brother is now the education minister, for example, and he has vowed to, quote, inject values of society and socialism into the educational system. There's talk of doing away with the National Assembly and of transferring legislative powers, what is left of them, to community councils. So all of this is happening at a time when Chavez is losing ground at home as well as in the rest of Latin America. So I think the ride will be bumpy here on out. Thank you.
I'm delighted to be here, and I'm much impressed by the product that that has come out of all this hard work by Sydney and by Veronica and by Annette. I think the book that you see today is an excellent point of reference. I think a lot of the chapters stand alone, and together they make for a very interesting and coherent read. I've read many of them myself. Use them for different projects that I've done and find them extremely, extremely interesting, and I'm sure that you will as well. I had the pleasure of writing about Bolivia, and I should probably provide my deep thanks to the editors because I was updating the chapters with every move by Evo Morales, or trying to keep pace with his own plan in Bolivia, which I think is exemplary of the resource nationalism taking place in certain parts of the hemisphere. Interesting to trace in a historical way how the liberal reforms of the 1990s were rolled back in Bolivia, with hydrocarbons as the central ingredient and natural gas being the key component in that mix. And use that as an opportunity to work on the natural gas issue in the Southern Cone in general, to draw other conclusions from other work that our program has done. So I'm grateful to Sydney for getting me involved in the issue of resource policy in the Southern Cone. The panorama for regional integration in the Southern Cone on the basis of natural gas is not a particularly promising one. Natural gas was the potential to be a motor for greater energy and economic integration in Brazil and the Southern Cone, but this potential has not been realized and is likely to not be reached because political rather than economic, technical, or geological factors are responsible for limiting the development of natural gas as an integrating variable in the region, above all in Argentina and Bolivia, which have the largest reserves of natural gas. Therefore, the prospects for a consolidation of a natural gas hub in the region that would lead to greater regional integration will be limited by policies inhibiting investment and production capacity in Bolivia and in Argentina. Peru, with proven reserves at current levels, cannot be expected to take up slack in supply. Key energy partnerships such as Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Bolivia, Argentina, Bolivia, Argentina, Brazil have been weakened in recent years and are likely to come close to reaching their potential. Lack of progress on regional energy integration based on natural gas, and again I'm talking about the Southern Cone, will limit the potential savings and benefits that such integration would imply for the economies of the region. Liquefied natural gas will play an increasingly prominent role in the region as key consumers, Brazil and Chile above all, seek greater flexibility and dependability of supply. Finally, the idea of a mega pipeline to move Venezuelan natural gas into Brazil with connections to Argentina is not economically feasible and unlikely to be realized. These are some of the rather unpromising findings of a recent seminar that our program conducted, but it is sort of part and parcel of the character of at least the chapters I've seen on the Southern Cone, especially Bolivia and to a certain extent Argentina. Thank you very much.
Thank all of you. Is this on? I guess so. Before I give the floor to all of you to make whatever comments you want, make any questions, I want to make two or three little comments. One, the editing of the book was really quite complex. It's got a lot of authors, and styles different, and it's thick, and there are a lot of data, a lot of charts. Roberta Howard Foreal, who's here, who's our editor, and I want to thank her. Two, those of you who have the book, if you look at the front cover, there are three names on it, apart from mine, Annette Hester, Veronica Prado, who's over here now. Veronica now lives in New York, works for the Council of the Americas. I don't think I could have kept going on that book without her, and I want to thank her for being here. She also wrote the chapter on the infrastructure, the whole network of pipelines and other things that exists. And finally, I'm not going to name them all because I'll leave out some. There are a lot of people in this room who helped out a good deal, companies, researchers, other people who know a lot about it all, people I consulted, people who helped me put on meetings of one kind or another. There are many of them in this room. They know who they are, I know who they are, and I want to thank them all. Thank you very much. Any questions, any comments? Oscar, go ahead.
Probably it's unfair to reduce a book like this to sound bites. But what is the key finding and the key recommendation?
Well, let me just give you two sentences. The key finding is that in South America, they don't cooperate very much, and they'd be better off if they did. There are a lot of more detail. And the key recommendation, that they do. No, I'm joking. Well, for the U.S., we have a lot of recommendations. And Frank may want to give what he thinks of the main word. That fair? Okay. Yeah, there are recommendations on U.S. policy and some of the shortcomings of U.S. policy. I don't want to list them all now, but there are shortcomings about how we go about how we, you know, the policies we have, how we conserve oil or how we don't, gasoline, how we don't conserve gasoline. There are many details. I don't want to get into too much of them. I don't think anybody comes off really scot-free among the countries in the hemisphere, although we have a little bit better things to say about some than we do about others. Yeah. Wait, Lynn.
I would like to know if there is any considerations on the role of the biofuels or ethanol is going to play in the relation with the U.S. and Latin America?
There's a discussion of biofuels, particularly ethanol, in the Brazilian chapter. This book was completed before all of the furor took off just about a couple of months ago, before the president visited Brazil, before that happened. So we decided we weren't going to change this just to pick up that whole furor, let it go through. On its own, but there is a good discussion of ethanol and what it might do, how it's been used in Brazil. I don't remember whether we talk much about corn-based or sugar-based ethanol, but we probably do. But the answer is yes, we picked it up.
Just to follow on that point about ethanol, and this is outside of the scope of the book, clearly, is it your impression that the lack of cooperation or examples of cooperation that you describe in the book on oil and gas are being repeated or are changing, are the patterns changing when it comes to biofuels?
I can answer that, but I don't want to. Let me see who I want to catch. Annette, she's been doing most of the work lately on ethanol, so why don't you pick that up?
I would say that I think it's okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I think that it's actually a new opportunity, and I'm seeing that the cooperation, although clearly a lot more, there's a lot of hype in what really is being done and not being done. But at least the willingness to cooperate and the complexity of the players' own internal dealings, because for the first time you have cooperation being proposed, whereas in Brazil's strategic interest, in the U.S. strategic interest. So that's what I was talking about before, about cooperation where strategic interests match. I still think that a lot more could be done in working on that, but at least it's one step in the right direction, in a lot better direction that I've seen in the oil and gas, where the cooperation is clearly difficult to understand how the as was mentioned before, how do you put a pipeline between Venezuela and bring gas down and then completely preempt Bolivia and sort of strand Bolivian gas? What kind of cooperation is that? But anyway, I think that, yes, the ethanol provides a possibility. However, it's also full of distortions, and the agricultural markets are incredibly distorted in their own right. So then you have, you know, distortions in agriculture, people in agriculture that don't understand energy and vice versa. And I keep asking them to talk barrels, and they keep talking bushels. And like, what's a bushel? And so it's early days, but I think a lot better that I've seen with oil and gas where I don't see a lot of light.
I think I promised over here, then over there.
Thank you, and congratulations to everybody. I wonder how much attention is paid in the book to two success stories. I mean, after everybody spoke, I had this great desire to cry. The two success stories I'm talking about, one is Trinidad and Tobago, that has basically done most things right, and the other one is Petrobras, which in recent years has really done a superb job of exploration and production, and is highly technically competent now.
They're good points, and both those are highlighted quite sharply. There is a chapter on Trinidad and Tobago in the book, and it makes that point. There are some shortcomings in Trinidad and Tobago, environment mainly, but that point is made, and they've been consistent. And for modest producers, they really have the U.S., the bulk of the U.S. LNG market, and they're planning for it. In the case of Petrobras, One of the things we mentioned this in the book over and over again, and at one point we compare Petrobras with Pemex in Mexico, not because anyone would naturally be more superior to the other, but because of the structure of Petrobras. Petrobras, for many of you do know, has private shares. You can buy Petrobras stock in stock markets around the world. When it comes to voting shares, the government, I think, has a one-vote majority. And they've developed experience for deep-water drilling. There's a map in the book that we got quite by accident, but I find it fascinating, and I keep repeating it. In the Mexico chapter, there's a one diagram, I don't know what page it's on, which shows, once you understand what that picture is, it shows the U.S. part of the Gulf of Mexico and the Mexican part of the Gulf of Mexico with a dot every place there's been a drilling. And the U.S. part is black with dots, and the Mexican part is almost white with no dots. And we're finding, I forget how much of our new oil finds in the deep waters of the Gulf of Mexico, and they're not.
Another success story, Colombia.
That's right, Colombia. I agree with that. Let me make a comment. These guys who know this stuff better than I do, this guy really does. There are national oil companies in all the countries except the United States and Canada today. All the rest have national oil companies. And after reading everybody's stuff and after going through my own, I spent a lot of time in Brazil trying to understand what was going on. Oh, I didn't write the chapter. The two national oil companies today, not it might have been different earlier in Luis's time, but today are Petrobras and Ecopetrol of Colombia, I think.
Lowell mentioned that he heard that for the first time Venezuela said there might be no compensation. And my question do you have any guess or idea from the companies or from Toby Batome or from other good sources in Venezuela that sort of in the ballpark what they might play? And the second part of that is any idea besides ExxonMobil which and how many companies might stay in Venezuela even if they have only 40% ownership because they've sunk so much capital based on the earlier law that Venezuela is changing.
That's a very good question. The companies are obviously, since they're in very delicate negotiations with the government, are holding things pretty close to their vest. What you do have to keep in mind is that they've got billions of dollars already sunk and invested in. And so I think it's reasonable to assume that if they can...
if any of you want to comment, just tell me.
Venezuela whatsoever, they're going to stay because they're of what they've already got invested. But I've talked to quite a few people, and the companies are really playing this very close to the best, which they have to. The, the little report I saw today about the hint of no compensation was the first time I've seen that or heard that. I guess it's not surprising to think about it. I mean, you look how the Venezuela handled both compensation for telephone company and for the electric company. They've just gone through that, so it's not at all surprising. But no, the answer to your question, I don't know. My guess would be that if they can stay, they're certainly going to stay because they've got a lot of money invested. As long as they're convinced that they can still make a buck or two, they're going to stay around to protect that investment.
Go ahead. I've been asked to say something, so let me add something to what has been said by Lowell. There is a large gap in Venezuela between what is said by the government and what is actually done, and that is the sign of almost everything you see around. And I can just make a quick comment about the operational agreements. When they decided, most of the things are said for effect more than reality of what's going to happen. When the operational agreements were changed and they used the word migrated into equity deals, there had been a couple of years of invoices in arrears to the companies. PDVSA was owing a lot of money to these companies. So when these companies had to pay for their equity to get into equity deals, they cleaned all these arrears, and now they're partners. But from then on, they were supposed to make cash calls every month for the two partners now, PDVSA and the companies. And what has happened in the year or so, over a year now, that they've had these equity deals is that PDVSA has not paid a single cent of that. I know the case, for example, of Chevron, which is $1.2 billion in arrears. Conoco was probably about 1.4, and every company has exactly the same situation. Concerning, and I'm going now to La Faja. La Faja, what they have said is they're going to go to 60% equity. And if you take the four big deals, probably they're going to need to pay about $8 billion or maybe even slightly more in order to really build their equity to 60%. The big question is not if the companies are going to stay. The big question is, are they going to pay for that and when? And the other question would be, who's going to operate? And my guess, as was the case of the operational agreements, is the companies that are now operating these deals, not only the fields, but also the complexity of the upgrading plans, are going to have, most of them are going to stay. And I don't know about Exxon. Exxon has had a tough position. But if Exxon would decide to leave, I would guess they would sign some kind of a compensation for Exxon, as they did in the phone company and also in the power company. So it is a very complicated game. Nothing that they say is really going to happen. It all depends on what's more convenient and at the same time what effect, political effect, anything they say will have.
Thanks, Sydney. I have a question not about energy, but about politics. Sydney's brilliant one-sentence summary of the book, as far as I gather, that you know in South America they don't cooperate very much, but they'd be better off if they did, and they should, kind of doesn't mention why they don't cooperate very much. And I gather, without yet having read the book, that one of the reasons that at the moment they're not cooperating very much is because of the triumph of politics over economics, and specifically a brand of politics, if you would, rather ideologized, populist politics fueled by an element of anti-Americanism. If that's the problem, the triumph of politics over economics, as part of the root of the lack of cooperation here, I sort of wonder, do the panel members have any insights about what would happen if suddenly, for the moment, South America got it right for a bit? That is, they did start cooperating and we did have more economically logical policies rather than politicized ones. Might it not just be a matter of time before we'd end up back in the soup that we're in because of the perverse interaction of economic cycles and the political opportunities that it creates for populace?
Well, let me try and answer what you said. Yes, it is politics and a lot of populism in some countries, but that's also augmented by history. Bolivia, Libya's problem is access to the sea, since they lost the war of the Pacific, 120 years ago. So they won't ship any natural gas to Chile, and they warn countries to whom they are shipping natural gas not to transship it. I don't know what will happen. Actually, there's some talks probably going on in the meetings now going on off the coast of Venezuela between Chilean President Bachelet and the Bolivians. They've been trying to talk on that because Chile, in addition to not getting the gas from Bolivia, Argentina broke a contract with Chile. They're shipping little bits of it, but they stop mainly because they're not producing enough for themselves. And the reason they're not producing enough for themselves is that when they had the financial crisis at the end of 2001, early 2002, what the president did in a populist move in order to build up his political strength, fixed the price at the devalued, only in pesos, and the devalued level of the peso, and it was only changed a week ago. So people didn't invest. They don't have enough to do for themselves. Let me just say a word, too, about Mexico. One of the questions, most Mexicans who think about it really would like to see the policy change to permit joint ventures with private companies, whether they're national oil companies, independent companies, so they could drill in promising areas like the deep waters. They have no experience in drilling in the deep waters. And one of the questions that keeps getting raised is, will they do this after the crisis or before the crisis? You take your choice on that one. I think what would happen if they ran right, they'd have more income. And they could use that income for, I don't necessarily think they'd all use it the way Chavez does. In other words, I think there are a lot more responsible countries down there than just that if they had greater income. But it's possible if they had greater income, they would use it in the same constructive way that Chavez was using it. I have a hand there, then a hand there.
Sydney, with regard to Mexico, what prospects do you see for changes with the new government? What kind of flexibility do they have?
When we had the conference in Mexico City, this gentleman had a big role in helping us have it, and I thank you for that. There were some very, very encouraging statements from Mexican senators from each of the three major parties. And the most lucid of the three was the one by, what's his name from the PRE, PRI? The fellow who'd been the presidential candidate, Labastida, who's a senator in charge of energy issues. His statement was really quite articulate, well said, quite accurate, and he said he would like to do something about it. In less elegant terms, the fellow from the PAN and the other fellow from the PRD made similar statements. And the old Mexican hands down there said, we haven't heard this before. This sounds encouraging. Well, okay. I took them at their word until they went back to their offices. And all of a sudden, it wasn't that. They have no intention of changing the Constitution. They're going to do it through laws. All right, now, I don't know if they can do it through laws without the court getting in the way. I can't answer that question. A good many Mexicans think they can, and a good many think they can, but it's unlikely that Calderon will pick this first year to try to pick an issue as sensitive as that. One of the points I make in the Mexican chapter is that we learned some years ago when a poll was taken together with the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations on attitudes in Mexico, most of the stereotypes that we had all grown up with, they didn't want to, they, They wanted to keep the U.S. They didn't want to cooperate with the U.S. They didn't want to work in Mexico with Americans, that they disliked Americans. All of those turned out to be inaccurate, at least according to this poll, except one, that the majority in favor of keeping out private enterprise, private equity in the oil business was just as it had been in sort of felt. The stereotype turned out to be accurate. So it's a tough issue for the Mexican president. I don't know what I'll do.
Can I add, just really briefly, I'm actually quite troubled also by looking at ethanol, which could be a possibility for Mexico for the settling of sugar cane and say, well, maybe that sort of could buy up some time and at least change a little bit of the energy matrix. And when I started looking, and sort of studying a little bit of the possibilities of ethanol in Mexico, and it's all distorted. And instead of fixing the problem that they have with sugar, they are just leaving that and creating a completely separate one with ethanol, and it's just as big of a mess as the energy sector. So I'm like, oh. It's a bit discouraging to figure it out that even what could be a possibility doesn't look quite as bright as
I was just wondering if there was any evaluation of the past performance of the oil and gas companies in South America, any recommendations or any linkage between their performance and the policies that are in practice in South America?
You have to look for that in each chapter. In each chapter, there is some of that. There is some of that, some discussion of the past experience of the country, even in Bolivia, for example. It wasn't just oil and gas. Just gas, it was also in other areas of some natural resources. In Mexico, there is some discussion of the nationalization and what prompted the nationalization of Mexico. Not too much, because that's well known. But references were made to it. I'm trying to think what other chapters may have picked up some of these points. But these points were included by particular authors as they try to write the political scenario in their chapters. But in some of the ones that I can remember, yes, they're mentioned, but not dwelled on. Yes, go ahead. Where?
On the issue of resource nationalism, there seems to be a prima facie assumption against the capacity of this type of strategy to deliver. I was wondering if anyone in the panel was able to spot either historically or hypothetically scenarios under which resource nationalism might work. At the end of the day, in other regions of the world, I would grant it's the exception rather than the rule, but there are national companies, Statoil, Petronas, Aramco, which have a very good record. What would it take for national companies in Latin America to perform well, or is it an impossibility from your perspective?
Well, I'll just answer part of it, then let me take it. We said Petrobras is performing well. It's a national oil company. And we also said that Colombia is performing well. Petrol, and they're even beginning to privatize it. But these fellows may want to give you more.
Allow me a comment, maybe. Before talking about the companies, I would make a comment about resource nationalism, because the question is, what do we mean by resource nationalism? Because when prices are high, everybody wants a larger piece of the pie, and that has happened for decades and years, and we tend to call that resource nationalism. And then, of course, even here in the United States, there was a discussion about raising taxes, including a windfall tax, and the same thing in the UK. So it's only natural. So I would separate that from what we could call resource nationalism, especially when resource nationalism means expropriation of fields like what happened in Bolivia or what happened even in Ecuador with one of the fields and maybe some of the cases in Venezuela. There is no single recipe for what a national oil company should look like if it's going to be efficient, but the most success has come to the countries that have been able to separate three things in some kind of a triangle, which is policy in the hands of the government, regulation administration in the hands of a regulatory entity, professional that will have people with continuity to deal with that, and the third vertex would be operations and business. If you can do that, which is exactly what was done in Brazil, it was Petrobras, which was done also in Norway with Statoil, and which is now the model in Colombia. I think you stand a very good chance of having a successful organization and good company.
Yeah, I would just echo Luis's sentiments that the sovereign has always controlled the resource. I don't care what country it is. When you negotiate contracts, typically there's a provision that allows for a change in sharing on PSAs. Most of the contracts that were negotiated with the companies in the 1990s, for example, if they were predicated on lower prices and the profit split changed over time, not a surprise when companies or countries saw that the commodity has strategic value and want to share in the upside potential. Very difficult for a company, as Lowell said, that has sunk costs to walk away from that. You can argue contract sanctity as a practical matter. You renegotiate. Having said that, I do think there's different classes of NOCs. And it's not only the ministries that control them, but when you talk about Petrobras or Saudi Aramco or Statoil, those are kind of the gold standard of the NOCs. And there's other companies that we all know at the opposite end of the scale. So I don't think there is a single formula, but there's got to be a way of balancing the resource interests and the economic interests of the country with the commodity and the value of the commodity. And equity participation, bringing new technology, new investment, and management at scale. That, I think, is the biggest piece. One of the things that the IOCs have historically brought is not only development within a region, but international development. So when you see a structure in the Caspian that looks an awful lot like the Gulf of Mexico, it really helps you out. If you've only worked in your country, you can't recognize the structures and what you can do to maximize and exploit the resource.
Thank you.